Right. My name is Emma. Today on Ride On Radio, I have the special guest, Matthew Thompson, and his newly released book on life support, Eco-Dystopian Cinema in the Long 1970s. Thank you so much for being here, Matthew.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Can you just give us a brief overview of what your job title is, quite frankly? I find it kind of fascinating.
Yeah, so I'm an assistant professor of film studies at the University of Regina. And there, basically, I teach courses in a department that teaches students how to make films. So most of the students are there learning all the different processes involved in making a film from, editing, cinematography, directing, sound design. But my role there is actually as, what's called a sort of studies prof. So I teach people about the history and theory of film so that they can make films that are informed by what's already come before, basically.
So, can you give me a brief overview about why you chose film studies as your profession? I'm curious as like, were you always into films as a kid, with like a little camcorder running around trying to film everything? Can you just give a little overview of that?
Sure. It's actually sort of funny. I think a lot of people who knew me as a younger person would be shocked to know that I was studying film now because I didn't grow up watching TV and I didn't watch a lot of movies, although there were certain movies that I watched over and over again, like Blade Runner, that did really influence me. But I got into it in my undergrad, actually. A prof was teaching a course in film studies and I took that class and it just really grabbed me and I became friends with the prof and he kind of mentored me and encouraged me. And I found I always loved reading, and I found, studying films to feel similar to studying literature, basically. And in some ways, you can sit down and watch a film in a night and kind of get a sense of the whole thing in a way that books, take longer, obviously, to consume.
As the production of a radio show host that mostly focuses on literary, I get it. Books do take time,
Yeah,
but
for
that's kind
sure.
of the beautiful thing of it. So for On Life Support, can you describe what was the idea for like, I'm going to make a novel based around eco-dystopian cinema, specifically in this one time frame in the 1970s, because it's very niche, but it's very poignant. We still reference a lot of these films today.
It is super niche, and often academic books like this choose a really sort of tight subject area. But the thing that drew me to this was basically I would say a couple of things. First of all, like I grew up as an environmentalist. I was always really concerned with the environment, and I grew up loving science fiction. And when I discovered this sort of cycle of films that were released in the 1970s that took up both a kind of environmental concern and were set in these dystopian futures, I was really excited by that. I wanted to like learn more about it, basically. And it felt like it was bringing together three things that I love: the environment, science fiction, and cinema into one sort of tight package. And sort of fortunately for me, these films are pretty limited. Like we have basically, this period starts around 1968 with the release of 2001: A Space Odyssey and The Planet of the Apes, and these are two like pretty dark, sort of dystopian science fiction films that are big budget. And so that sort of proves that that is a formula that works basically for Hollywood. And then we saw these, mid to large budget science fiction films like Silent Running and Soylent Green get released in the 70s. Until we have something like Star Wars in 1977 released, A New Hope, the first of the Star Wars franchise, and also Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And those movies were a lot more upbeat, optimistic, kind of escapist. And that sort of ended up bounding the period that I really looked at. And so that was very helpful academically to be able to say, this is this tight little chunk of films that I'm going to look at.
So what the thing I was always kind of curious about, I had like a big of environmentalism too. I have a geology degree, so I'm pretty familiar with like a lot of environmentalist movements. Particularly in the 70s, I always think of Superfund sites, especially in the US here, and contamination. And what I was always kind of, while I was reading through your book, I was like, oh, containment and contamination. Can you just like elaborate more about that thought process and what that exactly means?
Yeah, so what I sort of noticed in both reading a lot of the popular science environmental literature in the 60s, which inspired the modern environmental movement as we know it, so books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and others like Buckminster Fuller had a book called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. Paul Ehrlich had a book called The Population Bomb, and these were really influential texts. And what I noticed in reading those and then looking at the films that took them as inspiration was there was often a desire on the part of environmentalists to kind of contain and control non-human nature, to kind of create these enclosed sites. And Superfund sites would be a great example of this. Like they're fenced off, they're being cleaned up. It's like a specific area that is sort of being protected. In this case, they're protecting, everything else around it from being contaminated by it. But in the case of national parks, it's like an enclosed wilderness space. So we can be like, this part of the wilderness is preserved, and then we don't need to worry about the rest of the environment, like the environment in urban centers, for example. And then what I also noticed was a fear of contamination, or, a lot of environmental politics were motivated by this fear of contamination. And what I argue in the book is that while pollution, the sort of stuff that makes Superfund sites toxic, is obviously bad for the environment, the more that we acknowledge that there's no way to escape that contamination, the more ecologically we're going to act, basically. So if we pretend like we can cordon off a Superfund site and clean it up effectively without that impacting the larger environment, then we sort of convince ourselves that we can keep making these toxic waste sites in the future.
Oh, that's a good point in the book that you make. One of the things that, particularly when I'm going through this, I'm like reading, this is mostly my parents' generation because my dad grew up in the 70s. He lived in the Love Canal area, oddly
Oh, wow.
enough. So it's like I'm reading this, I'm like, okay, I could see my dad watching Soylent Green, all these other films. And the one thing that kind of struck me was just like dystopic it sounded. It was like a very Hollywood kind of blockbustery doom and gloom that like I don't think, and I'm not sure if you can pick out like any modern environmental movies that kind of have this sort of doom and gloom approach. I'm thinking of like Project Hail Mary that just came out, and I really like The Rock Puppet, but that one has an optimistic note on it. Is this something like this doom and gloom that's very specific to the 1970s, like kind of this film era, do you think?
I would say that it is relatively specific in the sense that there was a real mistrust of institutions in the 70s. We have the Watergate scandal, we have the Vietnam War, we have things like the OPEC oil crisis, and a number of other things happening that are making the public in North America particularly suspicious of large institutions and kind of have a dystopian outlook. But I would say that we're seeing a resurgence of this kind of film in the 2010s and 2020s. Stuff like Snowpiercer, I think, is a
Oh,
good
yeah, that's right.
example of like an ecological science fiction. And in that one, ironically, it's an environmental control that goes wrong, right? It's the cloud seeding sort of climate change mitigation strategy that goes wrong in that film and creates a nice planet. Also, Don't Look Up, I think, is a great example of a pretty pessimistic, you very easily read as eco-dystopian film. So I think we're seeing a return to that in a lot of ways, resonances with that moment in the 70s, for sure.
Why do you think that there's such a like the idea of science fiction and environmentalism? I never really thought as like kind of a hand-in-hand approach, but like after going through this book, I'm like, oh, it's like almost like intertwined. Like it's very hard to think of science fiction and non-environmentalism. Why do you think that is, especially for like most like a Western kind of audience?
Yeah, so I think the reason there's so much in common between these two modes, one's a sort of political scientific approach and the other's more sort of literary genre, but they're both really interested in the future, right? They both project the present into the future to imagine like what happens if we keep behaving the way that we are, or what happens if there's some new technological thing that changes, our relationship to the world. And they both often are a bit pessimistic about our chances, right? They have a kind of dystopian element and they even lean towards apocalyptic, right? Environmentalists are constantly telling us, the world is ending very soon. And science fiction also is really interested in that a lot of the time. And so I think these affinities really sort of help the two work really well together as a generic kind of combo.
I want to one of the chapters that stuck out to me was the like crustacean the fish, the whales and the dolphins, the one that specifically kind of targeted Save the Whales. And I'm wondering if you just kind of give an overview about that, because that was one of my favorites.
Sure, yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, that chapter was really fun to write, but like many whale-themed things, it like quickly balloons out of proportion. So it was very hard to marshal all of the sort of research that went into that chapter into a coherent narrative. But basically, in that chapter, I look at two films primarily. One's called The Day of the Dolphin from 1973, and the other's called Orca from 1977. And these are both films that basically are sympathetic towards whales and critical about people who harm whales. And the reason this is important for the environmental movement is in the 60s, There was this cetacean researcher named John Lilly, who worked with dolphins and was really confidently predicting that he was, a year or two away from teaching dolphins to speak English. So he basically set up this lab in the Caribbean and was conducting very bizarre experiments there that were influenced both at the same time, I show in the chapter, by the CIA and also by the sort of counterculture hippie movement. And so there he had these sort of like he took LSD, for example, and gave LSD to the dolphins and tried to communicate with them telepathically. And he wrote these engaging books about this sort of crazy science that he was doing. And lots of people read these books and they were super influential on, for example, the Greenpeace Save the Whales campaign. And basically, The Day of the Dolphin is this sort of classic 70s political thriller, but it involves dolphins who are taught to speak English on a Caribbean island and then are kidnapped by the CIA and sent to kill the US president in an assassination attempt, basically. So, very bizarre film, but basically almost like a fictionalization of John Lilly's own sort of research practice and lab. And then the other film is called Orca, and it's sort of like a remake of Jaws, basically, but with a killer whale instead of a great white shark. Even in the beginning, they have the killer whale kill a great white shark to be like, this, creature is even worse than Jaws. And that film is a kind of revenge of nature style horror where this killer whale is killing all the people on board this boat one by one. But throughout that film, you end up kind of cheering for the whale. You're like, yeah, kill these people. This whale is much more sympathetic. And so basically in that chapter, what I argue is that, whales and dolphins were contained within tanks in a way that's similar to the way we contain national parks. We use also photography to contain non-human nature within a sort of frame. And I make an argument that this kind of perpetuates this idea that we are in control of non-human nature. We are the ones responsible for protecting it. We know what's best. But when you think about it, for a dolphin or an orca who see the world through echolocation, being kept in a small tank is like similar to solitary confinement, basically.
What one of my first interviews I actually did on the show was Joseph Whitston's Marketing for Wilderness, that also has this idea of predominantly like white people containing nature, especially at the act of removal of indigenous folks, particularly within a Western framework. That was a very specific national parks. And what I really liked about that novel specifically is that it kind of pulled the rug underneath the ideas like national parks are for public good. But the idea of like Western, mostly white folks kind of controlling the narrative in terms of environmentalism. Did you find that pretty consistent throughout the this portion of the 70s as well?
Yeah, like a lot of mainstream environmentalism in the 70s was very white, very middle class, wasn't necessarily taking into account marginalized groups who predominantly suffer the negative outcomes of contamination. But what I found actually in the fourth chapter, I talk about this book and film called The Secret Life of Plants, really best-selling pop science book in the 70s. A lot of crazy claims in that book. But what's interesting is these two authors are searching out like every kind of crazy plant scientist they can find. And a lot of these scientists are not taken seriously by the scientific community because they're quacks. But some of them are not taken seriously by the scientific community because they're Indian or Black or have some other marginalized element that's making them basically not be taken seriously. And so then the film adaptation of this book, Secret Life of Plants, the documentary, is scored by Stevie Wonder. And sort of bizarre, Stevie Wonder, after a series of incredibly popular records, decided to score this pseudoscientific documentary about plants. But his score really highlights the fact that environmentalism is not taking into account Black communities living in sort of toxic inner city spaces. And what I argue in the book is that Stevie Wonder's album that goes with this documentary is like an early precursor to the environmental justice movement, which really brings together the civil rights and environmentalist movements in the 1980s. And so this album from the 70s, I argue, is sort of like a foretaste of that.
Can you elaborate more? Like, as I'm going through the book, there's like a portion in the la later chapter where it talks about overpopulation and kind of the racism implications of that. Can you elaborate more on that, please? That's a good one.
Yeah, so again, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, was very popular in the 60s. And he argued that because the Earth's population had doubled, I think, from the 1930s to the 1960s. So it went from 3 billion to 6 billion. And so, Ehrlich was thinking by the 1990s, are we going to be at 12 billion? Like, is it going to keep going at this rate? And that was justifiably scary. But what a lot of, Malthusians like Ehrlich are sort of secretly worried about, it seems, without necessarily being aware of it, is this sort of developing world, the global South, growing in size and starting to demand the kind of lifestyles that we enjoy in the West, primarily for themselves. And that's I think that this is sort of like one of the symptoms of colonialism and global capitalism, is that we sort of siphon off value from countries around the world and then try to sort of keep those people at bay. And we see that in this film, Soylent Green, which has a deeply overpopulated future. It's set in New York City, and there's something like, I think
It was like 40
that
million, if I
40
remember.
million. Yeah, I
Yeah,
think 40
something that's
million
just
people.
like, yeah, because the current population in New York City is somewhere between 8 million, I think.
And so it's set in 2022, 40 million people living there. It's a total dystopia, and everyone's surviving on these freeze-dried wafers, basically. It's difficult to talk about this film without spoiling it, so maybe I'll just say spoiler alert. Basically, in the end, you realize these freeze-dried crackers are made out of human remains, and that is, presented as a horrifying thing. But one of the things I argue in the book is that, one of the ways that we separate ourselves as humans from the natural world is we don't eat each other. We think of ourselves as non-edible, right? And that's a taboo that, serves all sorts of important purposes. But at the same time, I try to question that. Like, why is it that humans are inedible where all other creatures basically are edible? And what would it be like if we voluntarily, submit ourselves to be euthanized at the end of our lives and allowed ourselves to be eaten, which is basically what happens in the film. And so I try to argue for, in a polemical way, a reconsideration of cannibalism as a potentially ecological act.
The immodest proposal. I love that. One of the things I did find when I was going through this, like reading the film discussion of Soylent Green, was again with like the ocean, kind of coming back to the theme as like the ocean. And the only reason why the green doesn't work is because all the plankton died. And I'm kind of wondering, did you find that like the ocean was, or like a mode or like a theme of the ocean as being kind of consistent throughout these eco dystopian films? Because that was something that I was kind of struck. I was like, oh, the ocean. I don't know if it's because it's like more alien-like, quote unquote, unexplored by human development mostly. Just kind of wondering if there's like that parallel.
I'm trying to think. I hadn't thought about that, but definitely oceans served often as this, like, it's like inner space or something, like there's outer space and then there's the ocean, and they're equally kind of not explored. And science fiction often takes on these tropes of colonialism, like, the final frontier, sort of exploring and mapping these spaces. I think that when I'm thinking about, certainly the ocean features in Soylent Green, and also in all the sort of films in the whale chapter. Another film I talk about in that chapter is Star Trek IV, which is a little outside my period. It's from 1986, but in that film, basically, Kirk and Spock and the crew have to travel back in time to rescue some humpback whales and bring them into the future because they've been rendered extinct, so that they can talk to this alien probe that only speaks whale, basically. And that's sort of implying that that whales are actually aliens, and that they came from outer space, and that they have a longer kind of interstellar history than us. So there's definitely like this kind of idea in the 60s and 70s that the ocean is kind of like space, and that whales and dolphins are like the aliens. And one of the ways that Lilly, that sci cetacean scientist that I was talking about, got funding was he said, listen, if we're going to be contacted by aliens and we need to learn how to speak their language, we do very well to practice doing that with dolphins here on Earth first. So that was one of the ways that he got grant money.
Oh, really? I want to do that. Talk to
I mean, it
whales.
sounds great. It's just like, why didn't he learn dolphin, instead of trying to teach them English? It seems very strange.
One of the things I really like about the book is actually the cover art, which I was going through the pamphlet and I didn't realize it was a commissioned by NASA, if I recall correctly. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I adore this cover art so much.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really pleased with the cover. So it's this kind of illustration of what they call a torus, which is a sort of circular space station that has, all of these kind of like parks and houses, and it looks like a kind of almost like a urban cityscape inside of this torus structure. And it's an illustration that was made for a NASA report that was released in the 70s after the Apollo missions. They were sort of trying to say, like, okay, next step is space colonization. What are we gonna when are we going to get our first space colony up there? And they did a lot of the science to say, like, what would we need? How would we, do life support? How would we, grow food and process waste and house people and all these sorts of things, and how we get stuff up there. And they created this report, and they got an artist to do a bunch of illustrations imagining these kind of space colonies. And because the book is so much about the ways that we try to recreate nature in miniature, in spaceships, submarines, fallout shelters, greenhouses, dolphin tanks, all of these I think of as life support systems. So this image seemed to really kind of speak to what the book is about. And because it's from NASA, it was fair use too. So that was a really lucky coincidence.
I really do like how it does, like, also when I'm going through the book and going back and looking at the cover, I'm like, oh, this containment as well. Like, we're away from everything else. And it's definitely, when I went back and just researched, like, all the other paintings that were done. It's very suburban. It's very what, like, a very specific part of almost Norman Rockwell. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, Norman Rockwell looking space painting
Yeah,
from NASA.
that's a great point. I hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right. It's like a 50s sort of Pax Americana image of the world for sure.
There is one, I forget which one it was, but it was same kind of series of paintings, but it had like the white middle class family in the suburbs, and like the foreground and the background is like your 50s sprawl, quite frankly. It was like very on point. I thought that was very fun.
And another element of the cover too is we wanted it to look like 70s sci-fi paperbacks as well.
Oh,
So we used a lot
really?
of those as mood boards to kind of get inspiration because I love the look of like 70s paperback covers.
They do, and it's like that type font too that I really like. I was like, that is very much of a throwback. I have about two more questions here for you, and then we're gonna wrap up. What was your favorite film to like rewatch with like this kind of lens? If you watched it back in undergrad and you gained like more knowledge, I'm like, oh, I'm rewatching this film with like a more of a matured lens and a different kind of analysis. Which one was the one that you thought was the most striking, I think?
That's a great question. Probably the one that I saw earliest and then came back and rewatched, that I don't talk about extensively, but sort of informs the book in a lot of different sections, would be Planet of the Apes, the original 1968 version. I just find that film sort of endlessly fascinating, and it really is, feels timeless. And whenever people are asking me like a recommendation of which film they should watch too, from the various ones I talk about, a lot of the films I talk about, take some stamina to get through it, today. Like, they're not, what you would call, like, they're good films, but they're not like classically good films. But Planet of the Apes really, really holds up. And I find every time I watch it, I take something different away from it, I think.
And then my last question for you is like, do you have any other current research projects that you're looking forward to, either in lieu of this genre or you're going to pivot somewhere differently? What's on deck for you?
So right now I've been thinking a lot about gardening robots. That's the
Oh,
kind of thing that's on my
yeah.
mind these days. And I'm thinking about the way that we talk about AI and the kind of disjunction between what AI actually is doing and what science fiction kind of has primed us to think it's capable of. And so I've been talking about this film, The Wild Robot, which is a kids' animated
It's
feature.
so cute.
It's a great film.
I know.
But I think it also has these really interesting assumptions baked in about how AI and robots are going to be able to take care of the environment for us, and that we can kind of
Oh,
offload
interesting.
our environmental responsibility onto them. And also that's about kind of containing and controlling the ecosystem. If you've seen the film, you'll know that by the end, this robot has like made all the predators stop eating the prey for a winter so that everyone could survive. And that just seems to me to be like the opposite of ecology, So I'm on the lookout for any examples of gardening robots that I can find, basically.
Honestly, the first one I think of, and I don't know, I like this is just off the top of my head, the Wallace and Gromit film that was like released like 1 or 2 years ago, didn't have the evil penguin, but there was something about it where it's like the Wallace builds like this robot to take care of everything and it goes haywire, but it's like gardening. It does like, typical suburban English stuff, but it was really cute. But that's the first thing I think of. And
Oh,
apparently I had like
amazing.
such a cute family because I had like a personality. Kind of, it's like one of the classic stories. It's like, oh, you build a robot and it does simple tasks, and then over time it gains sentience kind of plot line.
Right.
So that's the first thing I think of.
Okay, I'll have to watch that. I haven't seen it.
I love Wallace and Gromit. That's just, it's just absolutely just pleasant. And it's, got moons made of cheese. All right. Thank you so much, Matthew Thompson. You could check out Matthew Thompson's book On Life Support, Eco-Dystopian Cinema in the Long 1970s at the University of Minnesota Press. And again, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.